Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace, your friendly podcast from Poland and Brazil, talking about life and technology from a developer's perspective, with me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How you doing over there, Rambo?
I'm still at home, John.
You're still at home. Mm-hmm. It's like, if this was a TV show, it would be the most boring TV show ever. It's like, he's still at home, and then he's still at home. On the previous episode... He was still at home.
Yeah, you know how TV and movies always show programming or like hacking as like this super intense thing, like with lots of colors and things flying around on screen. And in reality, it will be most of the time just someone boringly typing into a computer. It's super boring.
Yeah, exactly. It's like... If computing was like it's being portrayed in especially like Hollywood movies, it would be pretty exciting, but also probably very stressful and chaotic, right? Like imagine this like super colorful thing, lots of pop-ups popping up all the time, like lots of things going on the screen. Like I get it why they do that because it looks more interesting, like you also mentioned, than, you know, just the command line, but... That would not be a very nice work environment.
Yeah, definitely. So how have you been doing, John?
I've been doing pretty good, but I must admit that during the last few weeks, I've been feeling a little bit overwhelmed with my work in general. And what I mean by that is that I guess I've had a little bit of a hard time to decide what to focus on. And I've had this feeling that I've been kind of spreading myself a little bit too thin, where I have a lot of projects going on, and this is not... news. Like I've been having lots of projects going on for a while now, but lately I've been feeling like I've kind of hit a point where, you know, in the beginning when I hit this point, I started feeling like I need to cut down on the number of projects that I work on and kind of, you know, focus on a smaller number and do that. But then I thought a little bit about it and I kind of realized that the problem that I'm facing right now, or at least this is my theory, is not so much that I'm working on many projects at once, but rather kind of around my own expectations of how much I can do on each given project within each given week or day. Mm-hmm. So when I went full-time with Swift by Sundell, which was in January 2019, I started getting like all this time, right? Which I could use to work on Swift by Sundell, like to write articles, podcasting, all those things. Mm-hmm. And... By that, I could do much more. And, you know, if you go back and notice like my output on the site from December 2018 to January 2019 is a pretty big difference. Like I started writing these basics articles for more for beginners. I started doing videos recently, you know, doing way more tips, doing way more articles, and also expanding the scope also on most of the things that I do. So if you go back and read some of my weekly articles, which I've done now for over 3 years, from like just a year or two ago, they are way more simple and, you know, shorter and don't have as much like elaborate examples and things like that. So I've been definitely like growing everything that I do in scope a lot and also added a lot of new channels. But I guess that, you know, my kind of expectation on myself has kind of been that since I'm now doing this full time, I should be able to do like one thing every day. So one new article or podcast episode or one kind of piece of output every single day. And on paper, that kind of makes complete sense. Like you look at that and you think, you know, before I did this full time, I was able to write one article every week, and I typically did that on Sundays. So I spent like 3 or 4 hours every Sunday writing an article and publishing that. So now that I work on this full time and I have, you know, 5 days a week that I work on this, I should be able to at least put out like 5 articles or 5 podcasts, you know, 5 pieces of content every week. Makes sense on paper, right?
Yeah.
The problem is that life is not paper, right? So these expectations that I had and these kind of plans that I had around how much I think I could do in a given day didn't take into account like all of the other things that I have to do on a weekly and daily basis. So there's a lot more to running a company and doing the work that I do than just the actual output, right? Like writing the articles is kind of like the end result or like the final step in a much larger process where I both have to do a lot of research and play around and experiment with things, which I love doing, but it's a big part of the work. I also have to like work on projects and write code and things like that in order to have things to write about and to get like inspiration and ideas. And another big thing, which is, you know, ties into the whole business aspect, is that I have to fund it somehow. And the way I fund my work is through sponsorships. So I have to do a lot of sales and reach out to sponsors and work with them and scheduling and copy writing and you know, all these sorts of things. There's a very, very large chunk of my work, especially now as the economy is not in the best state that it's ever been in globally. So I've had to do a lot of work recently to like reach out to sponsors and work with them and come up with plans and stuff like that. So what ended up happening is that there was a big disconnect between my expectations that I had on myself, this whole idea that I could output one thing every day, and my actual capacity. And this kind of started leading me to feeling a little bit stressed or feeling like I was kind of underperforming. And this was all kind of in my head, right? There was no one saying, like, there was no one pinging me on Twitter or sending me an email like, John, why haven't you written something today? Why are you lazy? Like, that didn't happen. This was all kind of internal to me, right? And my own desire to kind of perform well and to really contribute to the community and to publish things that people enjoy on a regular basis. So what I've done now during the last few days to kind of fix this problem, like to fix this disconnect, is to really like do the opposite, where instead of having this like very aggressive idea that I will always be able to publish something every day, to say, let me publish my weekly articles every Sunday, let me publish my podcast every 2 weeks, Stack Trace every week, like those three things, that those are my kind of regular things that I do on a schedule. Mm-hmm. And then let me do one additional thing per week, right?
Yeah.
So it can be answering a question like my new Q&A series, like we talked about on the previous episode. It can be writing a tip. It can be writing a basics article. Like I have all these different things that I work on, making a video, etc., right? And that I feel like is a more realistic view of the world because it gives me time to do all these other things that I have to do. It also gives me time to do things that I want to do and to explore new ideas and prototype and all of these different things. And it also gives me the additional flexibility to be able to like handle the business and make sure everything is going smoothly and all those things. So I feel like I want to share this because I feel like we talk so much about productivity on this show. I talk a lot about it in general. And I always like to say this, and I'm sorry if I sound like a broken record, but to me, productivity is not about working all the time. It's about working smart, and it's about working in a way where you feel happy about the things that you produce and the amount of things you can produce. And I guess I want to share this just to say that I'm not perfect. And sometimes I get too ambitious. I have too many plans. I have too many things going on. And it might not be that I have too many actual projects, but just that my expectations are not connected to reality. And I just needed to do that reality check to figure out a better schedule and a better expectation for me going forward.
Yeah, and also in the current situation, I think it's perfectly fine if you're not being 100%, if you're not performing 100% of what you used to perform before everything went to hell, basically. Like,
right.
Yeah, it's perfectly fine for you to be spending more time not being productive right now. And it's not like an excuse. I think it is perfectly fine and it's normal. And beating yourself up for it is only going to make it worse. So, feel free to not be productive a little bit.
Yeah, that's very nice. And another thing also that I kind of a little bit lost track of there in the middle of everything was I've never been a person that just wants to produce the most things. Like if someone says to me, oh, John, like the best thing about your website is that you're just producing so many things. Like that's not necessarily like what I want. Like what I want to hear is that I am producing really good quality things, right? Like I want to always go for quality over quantity. And of course, I want to have a good coverage and I want to make sure that there's enough things published on the site that kind of keeps it going and that people are interested in coming back and there's something for everybody. Like I want to make sure I have the coverage as well. But the most important thing for me is the quality. So I don't think I have sacrificed on quality in order for quantity, but I was kind of heading in that direction and I was having the wrong priorities, I feel like. So now I'm kind of just like reprioritizing and really going back to basics for myself to say like, the most important thing for me is to always maintain a high level of quality so people can trust my work, they can enjoy it, they know that it's good, and not necessarily focus too much on just like always outputting new things.
Yeah, and also it's important to not be obsessed with quality to a point where it hinders your ability to deliver. Like, it is important to care about the details and care about quality, and to be a perfectionist to some extent, but you need to find a balance there and not be too crazy with that, because I've been down that road before. I'm not that old, but I have learned that if I let myself be the perfectionist self that I am, which I am, but if I let myself be that person when I'm doing stuff, I will never deliver on anything, because I'm always going to be like, oh, this is not good enough. This app is not ready to ship. This podcast episode is not good enough. It's never going to be good enough for you, but for other people it is. So yeah, you need to really find that balance.
Yeah, I totally agree. And what I really like about my setup, and what I definitely want to keep, is this weekly schedule that I'm on. So the fact that I am publishing every week and I have that kind of pressure, if you will, but you know, I have the schedule, I need to ship every week. Like, that gives me this kind of deadline that forces me to strike that balance, where if I say every day, the deadline is too tight, right? Like, I will need to at some point kind of compromise on quality in order to meet the deadline, which I don't want to do. But if I would say I'm going to write one article every month, then it would go in the opposite direction. Like you also say, like, I would be spending too much time like polishing things for and not getting that return on that investment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So after that long kind of productivity and reorganization monologue, what have you been up to, Rambo?
Well, it's actually funny because this weekend I was doing some cleanup, which was kind of similar to your theme of keeping focus and getting rid of the things that I think were getting in the way of me doing the things I really want to do. So unfortunately, I had to kill two projects, which I really liked in that process, but it's important for me. So unfortunately, I am very sad to inform that both Sharecuts and the splash.rambo.codes projects are dead.
I will never forgive you.
I should have done like something with a coffin, like the Steve Jobs thing with macOS 9.
Exactly. No, that makes total sense. And, you know, it's one of those things where now that you have pulled the plug on Sharecuts, it doesn't mean that it was a bad idea, right? It doesn't mean that it was something that you shouldn't have done. Like, it kind of lived its life, right? Mm-hmm. And it kind of provided a purpose for a while. And now when the kind of sharing of Sharecuts, the sharing of shortcuts, the sharing Sharecuts in the system of shortcuts has been improved by the system and, you know, by Apple, then Sharecuts kind of has played out its role, right?
Well, and to be honest, Apple played a big part in killing Sharecuts, because in iOS 13, they killed the ability to import shortcuts from external URLs. And that's how Sharecuts worked. It was supposed to be an archive as well as a place for you to get your shortcuts. And when I talked to people in the Shortcuts team about that, they basically said, yeah, you're going to have to use iCloud URLs now. And okay, but what do I do with this 500 shortcuts, which are already here and are not iCloud URLs? And also, I would lose the archival aspect of the website. So that was basically all of the nails in the coffin at that point.
Right. Yeah.
Because, yeah, I didn't, and it would like require a big re-architecting of the whole website. And I didn't really have the bandwidth to do that or the will, because one of the things I really liked about the website was the archival aspect. And yeah, so with iCloud links, I would lose that. So what I did is to preserve the content, I actually replaced the website with a static page using Publish, by the way.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I made it like quite quickly. So I just basically exported the database of Sharecuts as a JSON file, and in the published website, I have a little Swift code that reads the JSON and creates this archive list where you can see all the shortcuts and download them. So that they're still available, it's just like not the system anymore, it's just a static archive.
Right, yeah, that makes sense. And that's also nice because you're kind of preserving backwards compatibility to some degree, right? And, you know, if someone wants to use it or they have some kind of workflow around it, they can still keep doing that. So, but you don't have the kind of maintenance burden and the maintenance cost of maintaining that dynamic, flexible site with the database and the hardware and all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And for Splash, it was the same thing. I didn't have time to give it the attention it deserved because, of course, Splash deserves more attention. And so I thought it would be best to direct people to use the library directly instead of relying on the website. I think, and it's the same thing as with Sharecuts. I think it was important that I did it and it was useful during its existence as like a demo of Splash and like a first look, the dynamic, interactive first look into the library. But now that it's been established and then people are using it, I think there's no need for the website anymore.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things that Apple, I think, faced with the Apple Watch, where when you design a product or a library or whatever it is, like you design something, you don't really know how it's going to be used, and you can bake a bunch of different features into like the 1.0, the initial release, but then it might evolve and change and get different priorities as it spends time in the wild and as people use it in different ways. So with Splash, for example, I released it with a bunch of different tools around like creating images and generating HTML, of course, like markdown tools. There were like a suite of different command line tools, and over time, how people actually end up using it has kind of, you know, been focused around certain particular areas where, for example, providing syntax highlighting on a website as part of a blog or something like that is probably the primary use case. And that was not what your tool was doing. Your tool was like generating an image from the code, right? So I think that's also something that is worth keeping in mind where, so when you release a product, it might be like super relevant right now, this particular feature, but then after a while, like after 2-3 years, something like that, you might just have shifted your priorities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that makes perfect sense.
Cool. So Rambo, have you been up to anything else? I suspect that you have also been doing some work on AirBuddy. Is that right?
Yes, definitely. I had some struggles with dark modes in AppKit. You know, dark mode is really great. I love it. I use the auto mode on both my Mac and iOS, so it switches at night. But there are some details about the way it works in AppKit, which aren't as easy as in UIKit, which seems to be a theme. but yeah, it's weird that like you can only reliably get the current system appearance within certain contexts, like within the drawRect method for a view or update layer and some other specific methods. If you try to get the current appearance, or even if you like set a color elsewhere, it like won't reflect the current appearance. And I had a bunch of issues related to that in AirBuddy 2, where if you switched modes, it wouldn't reflect correctly. And this is only a problem now because AirBuddy version 1 does not support dark mode. I didn't support dark mode because the main interface of the app is this pop-up that shows the device animation. And that device animation used to be a video with a white background. So there was nothing I could do really to support dark mode.
Right.
But a little bit later, Apple changed that to be a video with a transparent background, which is supported starting on Catalina. So for Catalina and beyond, AirBuddy 2 is going to support dark mode. And I'm happy to say that I've been able to figure out the fixes to the issues I was having with dark mode.
Nice. And was it just like moving the code to a code path where you're always getting the correct appearance? Or did you have to do some other kind of tricks in order to make it work?
It was mostly that. There were some things I was doing in view controllers, and to the best of my knowledge, I couldn't find anything within an NS view controller that would work, like where I would get the correct appearance. I couldn't find any method. Even some methods that are documented as part of UI view controller. And this is something, if you allow me to rant a little bit here, but...
sure, go ahead.
Like the documentation for supporting dark mode in your apps, at least the one I could easily find by Googling, that documentation is like a mix between AppKit and UIKit. So there are some things like... it says that you can use this particular method in UI view controller, and the same method exists in NS view controller, but in NS view controller it doesn't work. So I had to do some moving around of code basically, and it's just like it. I always feel bad about doing things in hot code paths such as DrawRect or update layer and things like that. It just, I don't know, it's just like a thing where I'm like OCD, like, ugh, this is going to be called like 50 times. And I know that it's like super optimized and it doesn't really matter, but anyway.
But it's a good practice to have in general, yeah, to not put too much code in these hot code paths, because most of the code I would say that we write when we write these kind of user interface based apps on the Mac or iOS or another platform, they're mostly responding to user events. So you don't necessarily usually need to run things at like 60 frames per second. It's very different when you build a game. And we can once again put a link in the show notes as a tangent to my game written using Swift UI as my little hack. You can see that I'm actually observing the display link, the CA display link, and getting a notification on every draw of the screen and updating my view hierarchy. So that's a very common pattern when you're doing game development, because you want to render the current game state and it's updating so quickly based on everything like the game state itself, user input, timing, all stuff like that. So you need to render on every frame, but that's typically not the case in a typical iOS or Mac app. So avoiding those hot code paths, like you say, and doing things more lazily, if you will, or doing them when you get that specific event is usually a good idea for performance.
Yeah, definitely. And this is something that will be running for potentially like months. Like the AirBuddy helper process can run for an indefinite amount of time if the user never reboots their machine, or if it doesn't crash, which hopefully it doesn't. So I need to be mindful of that. And also, this particular user interface shows up in circumstances such as you opening your AirPods case next to the Mac. So I don't want the fact of you opening the AirPods case next to your Mac to cause like a 200% CPU spike or something. That wouldn't be good.
Yeah, that's true. Now, it's very good that you have these principles, I think, and that you're really keeping the not just the user experience in mind, but also like the overall experience, like the battery life and your impact on the system. I think it's very responsible of you, Rambo, and I think it's very, very good.
I don't want to be battery shamed.
Right, that's true. I just wanted to quickly go back to one thing you said earlier here. You said that you are using auto mode on your computer that automatically toggles between dark mode and light mode. And this is a good recommendation, I think, for developers in general. Like if you're doing any Mac development or if you're doing web development, I would really recommend using the auto mode. And I also recently switched to it for that particular reason, where I personally love dark mode. But if I only use dark mode all the time myself, the risk that I accidentally ship a bug in light mode is very high, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because if I will only dog food my own website or, you know, the apps that I'm working on in dark mode myself, it's very, very likely that I will miss something in light mode if I'm only checking it like for 5 minutes before shipping it, right? Which is my typical workflow. So now I use auto, which is great because I've actually seen some things I would like to update and fix on my website, for example, around the light mode theme. So dog fooding is always great, and I think this is a great way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually caught these problems when I moved to auto mode, because if you run the app starting in light or dark mode, it would work fine before, because that those paths where the appearance is not reliable, they would get the correct appearance because it's been the same since you launched the process.
Yeah.
But the problem arises when the appearance is changed while the process is running. So I wouldn't catch that unless I would like actively try it out and change the mode with the app running, which is something that before I ran into this, I didn't even know could be a thing. Like, I assumed that if my app works in both light and dark mode, it would handle the switch correctly. But I was terribly wrong.
Right. All right. So this has been a really interesting discussion, both about priorities and indie life and battling with dark mode and killing off old products and everything. So always fun to give you our regular weekly updates. But now let's talk a little bit about what's been going on this week in the world at large. What have you got for us this week?
Oh, John, I got a good one this week. Yeah. Twitter had a problem last week.
Oh, yeah, I heard about it.
The way it came to my knowledge was by someone sending me this link to a tweet in Apple's Twitter account, at Apple, saying, like, we would like to support our community and give back. We support Bitcoin, and we believe you should too. All Bitcoin sent to our address below will be sent back to you doubled. And this was in Apple's Twitter account, the official at Apple account, which, by the way, and this is kind of ironic, this was the first tweet ever in that account.
Because, really?
Yeah, because they only use this account for ads, so they will do like these tweets that are ads, but they don't show up in their home feed.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is kind of ironic. It's like, hello world, here's some Bitcoin.
Yeah, so the first thing I thought when I saw this tweet by the Apple account, and this was before I knew what was actually going on, is that, like, oh, something happened and like someone got access to Apple's Twitter accounts. Like, maybe they were using a weak password, maybe they didn't use 2FA, maybe someone left a post-it in like their computer with the password or something like that. But then lots of other accounts started to publish similar tweets. That includes Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Mike Bloomberg, the official Uber account, Barack Obama, and many others. And then I thought, oh, maybe this was like one of those services that companies and marketing firms use for tweeting to like these high-level accounts that have lots of followers. And it's basically like someone is managing your account for you. But then I noticed that all of the tweets were from the Twitter web app. So that was not the case. So basically, now what happened is someone got access to an internal tool, an admin tool within the Twitter system that allowed them to get control of these accounts.
That's right, yeah. And this is an interesting attack vector in a couple of different senses where, you know, the user-facing protections, like we're talking about password, username, two-factor authentication, you might have these SMS tokens that are sent to you and you have to put in a code. Like, there are many different mechanisms and protections when it comes to kind of the user-facing login screens to prevent someone from getting unauthorized access. But once you're in the castle, right? Like, once you get access to one of those internal tools, they don't have the same protections, you know, between accounts. Because once you're in that admin panel, you can typically, you know, perform all sorts of different actions on different accounts without having to, like, authenticate every single time, right? Because these are tools used by customer service. They're used by, you know, hopefully not like developers in the company. Hopefully there's like some kind of protection that there's only a select few people who need access on that level that have that kind of access. But it's an interesting attack vector where this is not some kind of like brute force hack, like, you know, figuring out someone's password or getting access to their two-factor or something like that, but actually like going the other way, like going around all of those protections by getting access to an internal tool.
Yeah, and I think this was a huge mistake on Twitter's part. Not this hack, because it wasn't like their direct fault, But I think such a tool shouldn't even exist. Like, or at least not in the way that it exists now, because clearly it didn't have enough belts and suspenders to prevent something like this from happening. Because what it looks like is that this tool, by the way, this is speculation, we don't know for sure, but given the circumstances and that someone external to Twitter got access by using social engineering, which is what Twitter mentioned, it looks like this tool only required a username and a password.
Yeah, that's a very big mistake.
Yeah, and like if I have a username and a password to this tool, I can take over any Twitter account on the planet, including like the President of the United States, Apple, Uber, and other very important accounts that could... I mean, tweeting about Bitcoin was, in the grand scheme of things, fairly harmless, besides the fact that, of course, people fell for it and that's sad, but it could have been much worse. It was, unfortunately. But this tool requiring just a username and a password, that's bad. And even then, if it required more than that, like let's say it didn't have 2FA, probably wasn't strong 2FA because someone else got access by doing social engineering. But if I have access to this tool and I'm someone like some employee on Twitter, I'm using their account, I shouldn't be able to just take over any random account. Like that's crazy. Like it's like having direct access to the database or something. It shouldn't be possible.
Yeah, I totally get what you're saying, but I have to play devil's advocate here a little bit because there's another aspect here that is really important to consider, which is the customer service aspect, where if you build a system, a perfect system that is perfectly encrypted, perfectly secure and everything, that is not always the best for the user experience. And what I mean by that is that, say someone forgets their password or they drop their phone and they can no longer access their two-factor authentication, or something else happens that makes it impossible for this person to log in using that secure method that you're typically logging in using. Not having any form of, for the lack of a better term, backdoor. I know that backdoor usually refers to something else, right? But not having another way that the company can access your account and help you restore it is a problem, right? That's something that I think a lot of customers and users expect. Like, if I forget my password, I can just go and call their support or email them and they help me restore it, right? That's an expectation that people have.
Yeah, I totally get you, John. And I heard other people say similar things, but there should be a process. Like, there should be, like, the system should, like, require that there is a support ticket opened in the first place for you to be able to do anything. Like, it should require maybe sign off by someone else. Maybe, like, the kind of like those scenes in movies where you have to, like, to open this door and turn a key and another person has to turn their key at the same time. Like,
yeah.
There should be something like that. It shouldn't be just, like, a username and a password and I have access to the system and I can just go take over accounts willy-nilly, like any account.
I totally agree with that as well. And I think perhaps also there should be, if there isn't already, it doesn't seem like there is, but there should perhaps also be different processes and different safeguards in place for different accounts, right?
Yeah.
Because the Apple account is a bigger target than an account that some person creates today and they just created it and it has zero followers and they haven't started using it at all. Like, there's a range there between this brand new account that has no activity, no followers, nothing, and an account like Apple's or Elon Musk or one of these accounts that have millions of followers. So hopefully there should be some kind of different scale there as to what kind of hoops you have to jump through in order to perform this kind of action on those accounts.
Yeah, I think this was the classic thing in security where there wasn't enough thought put into what could go wrong.
Right. And it was working, right? That's another aspect. Like, especially when you have these companies that started from scratch, like, you know, every company does. But in the beginning, you're always taking shortcuts and you're perhaps not thinking, like, when you're starting designing something like Twitter or any other app that you and I start today, we're not thinking, oh, what's going to happen if Elon Musk is going to use this, right? Like, that's, or Apple is going to use this. That's not what you think in the beginning. I mean, if you do, you have pretty grand plans, right? So you're not necessarily designing for that in mind. And I know in the perfect world, you should always think about, you know, everything, privacy, security, designing everything in a perfect way, scalable way, but that's not always how it works in real life. Again, life is not paper, right? Like, that's not how it always works out. Yeah. So I can also see this being a thing which kind of was implemented many, many years ago when Twitter was super small, and it's just been left this way. And since there hasn't been a problem, no one has kind of revisited it because it's just been working, right? Like, why fix something that's not broken? But sometimes you do have to revisit and upgrade and fix legacy systems that were made under different assumptions.
Yeah. I mean, at least they could have done, like, hard calls the idea of, like, the top 100 accounts or something. And if there is a reset thing, like the, oh, I want to change the email on this account, it requires, like, signing off by Twitter CEO or something.
Right.
It wouldn't be that big a problem for him. I don't think this would happen frequently, legitimately. So, yeah, my point is that Twitter has been big enough for long enough that this should have been foreseen.
Yeah, and hopefully they will learn from this. And like you mentioned, the fact that it was a Bitcoin scam that didn't seem to go that well. Like, the we don't have any real numbers, of course. I don't think so.
It was between 100 and 200K. So it's a lot of money, but not worth the risk, in my opinion.
Right, and not in the grand scheme of things, right? Yeah. Like, this is something that it could have been used for, like you say, way more destructive purposes, but thankfully it wasn't. Hopefully they will learn from this, and hopefully they will improve, and they will really, like, put these different practices in place and these additional security measures so that this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so this was a very serious incident, and I know that during this segment we had a bit of a laugh and things like that, but that doesn't mean that we don't take this seriously. We really do, and again, like, we really feel bad for anyone who lost money in this scam and things like that. Like, that's of course very, very bad, but yeah, hopefully we can all learn something from this, including the folks at Twitter, and hopefully things will improve for the better.
Yep.
But now let's move on to our next segment, which is our deep dive. And typically when we go on a deep dive on this podcast, we like to go deep into a given technology and talk about different APIs and implementations and things like that. But on this episode, we thought we would do something a little bit differently and go on a deep dive into engineering management. So, Rambo, this was kind of prompted by us talking about management, and you've now been stepping into a role at your jobby job, which involves a lot more management. Is that right?
That is correct.
So, can you tell us a little bit about that and kind of what led you to go into engineering management?
Yeah, so basically we changed a lot of our staff, in part due to the situation. We were impacted by the COVID situation. So the engineering management role for the mobile team was empty. And I was asked if I would like to take on that role. And I was already a bit of a leader in the iOS team, at least. So I decided, well, why not? Let's give this a go.
Nice. And that's kind of a little bit how I also once ended up becoming an engineering manager. It was because my manager, when I was working at Spotify, went on parental leave and basically asked me, can you step in, John, for like 6 months while I'm on parental leave? Because in Sweden, we have pretty long parental leave. I said, well, yeah, I can try and see how it goes. And I became kind of an accidental manager. It was accidental.
Nice.
So how have you been finding it so far, being a manager, and how has your kind of day-to-day changed?
Yeah, so as expected, I am touching code a lot less. In the company, we do have a culture of managers don't stop doing day-to-day stuff. Like, you're not expected to not code at all as a manager, which I think is great. Like, at least for me, I do like that I can still touch code. But yeah, it changed in that I am touching a lot less codes. I am still doing things. But the main thing that changed is that I have a lot of meetings now.
Yep, that's what every manager says always. And I also remember, like, when I was at Spotify being a manager, that my calendar went from pretty much like empty to just completely full, like overnight, because I got invited to all of these recurring meetings and sync. And, you know, you had to kind of meet with all different parts of the organization that your team was connected to, right? So you had to meet with like engineering management, you had to meet with recruitment, you had to meet with product, you had to meet with so many different people like every single week. So it all just added up to a big puzzle of meetings.
Yeah, I don't have too many, I think it's still in a good number. I only have like 3 that are almost every week, and they're short. This is also a good thing about the jobby job. I think nobody really likes long meetings, but we do need to talk. And I think especially now that everyone basically is working remotely, the company has always been remote friendly, but now everyone basically is working remotely. So it is important to sync up every now and then, and talking instead of just texting is better in some aspects. So yeah, I'm happy that they're not like 5-hour meetings.
Yeah, no, that sounds very, very good. I don't think I could take more than like an hour of meetings. Like that would be too much for me. So the reason I wanted to bring this up, and when we started talking and we thought this was a good topic for this deep dive, is I feel like there's a lot of developers who see management as a kind of natural or maybe even inevitable part of their career, where you start going from like you're a junior developer, then you become like a senior developer at some point, then you might become a lead developer or whatever different terms your company uses. And then at some point, it's like you've kind of hit the ceiling as a individual contributor or as a programmer. And then if you want to progress, you go to management. Like, this seems to be a very common understanding of the typical kind of career ladder, if you will, or kind of map that you're progressing through your career. So I thought this could be an interesting point to just talk about that, and to talk about, you know, is that true? Is it true that you have to go into management at some point? And what might be some of the alternatives if that's not true? So is that also kind of the way you feel around now becoming a manager, that you are kind of progressing in your career?
If you are an iOS developer, you have to either become a manager or a podcaster. Isn't that how it works?
You're both.
All kidding aside, I don't think so. Like, I've never been a believer in that, like, you have to grow in your career and become a manager. No, I don't think that's necessary. There are people out there and they like to code and they are very good at that job and they're very good programmers and problem solvers. And I don't see why you would take, like, this is something that can happen. Like, you can take your best programmer and turn them into your worst manager.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
I think it has to be a thing where that particular person likes the idea of being a leader for a team or a manager for a team. And if you have people in your team that don't like that idea and they don't want to do that, I think there should be other options. And I'm basically talking here about money. Like, if you are, say your company uses like the tradition, like, you're a senior developer now, and that's the most you can be in this company as a programmer, is a senior programmer. And after that, like, you're never going to get a raise again or something like that. I think that's wrong. Like, if the person is providing more value to you, I think they should be allowed to get like a raise without necessarily becoming what they don't want to become, in this case, a manager.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And The money aspect is, of course, an important aspect because, you know, you want to feel like you're growing in that sense, but you also want to feel like you're growing in kind of the personal development sense and mm-hmm. your tasks and what you're working with. And there are only so many table views you can write in your career until you don't want to write any more table views. And now we have Swift UI, so now it's all changing, right? That's great. But what I mean by that is that you want to have this feeling that you, or at least a lot of people do, they want to have this feeling that they get to work on different things and maybe they get to use the experience and the skills that they've accumulated during their career in a different way. So for example, one way to go, I think, as an individual contributor that you can do in some companies is that you can go to some kind of project management that is very technical. You can go to some kind of architecture role where you get to work on more high-level problems. You can go and work on what I did at Spotify, for example. When I was working as a lead developer, I was working on a project that affected a big part of the organization. So I got to embed with different teams and work with them on architecture and integration and these kind of problems. That was super interesting, right? Like, it was still doing development. It was still very technical. I was still writing a lot of code, but it was kind of a more higher level position than being quote unquote just a developer. So I think there's a lot of options here for companies, but it requires a little bit of creative thinking and going a bit beyond the traditional, like, a programmer is a person who sits down and writes code every day and that's all they do, right? Yeah. Because I think the other approach you mentioned there, which is to have that ceiling to say, if you are just a senior developer now, you cannot go any further. It's a great way to lose people because people eventually are going to get bored or they're going to get a better offer and they're going to leave.
Definitely. Yeah, that's definitely the case. And I must say that this depends. It changes a lot depending on the company, like you mentioned. In my situation, I'm much more of like a tech lead and technical manager than like a people manager. Like, I'm not going to be firing people, for instance. That's something that's delegated to a higher level in the job. So that will vary a lot depending on which company you're working for.
Right. Yeah, it really does. So the people management aspect there is interesting because what happened to me, so I mentioned I was this accidental manager. I was a manager for about 1 year, actually. Like, my manager at the time came back, but I still kept the title and I was still managing people because we had grown at that point. So we were kind of, you know, spreading out and helping each other. But then at some point, I realized that if I'm going to do both, like both development, because I still was coding and I still wanted to code a lot. So if I'm still going to do that and also be a people manager, it's going to keep being more and more difficult. It kind of ties back to what we were talking about in the beginning of this episode around spreading yourself too thin. Mm-hmm. I think this is a common theme for me in my career is that I always, I get ambitious, I want to do everything, and then I spread myself too thin and then I reorganize. And so in this case, I kind of realized that I'm going to have to decide between the two at some point. We had grown so much, there were so many people to manage. So if I was going to keep being a people manager, I would have to kind of focus on that because I felt like I was kind of neglecting both at some point. And that's when I decided to actually go back and become a full-time coder again. And then I took that different path later to become kind of a more of a lead developer and project lead. But I think that's also an important point to point out here that it doesn't always have to be that manager is just the next step. For me, it's a very different job. And I didn't feel, when I went back to becoming an individual contributor again at Spotify, I didn't feel like I was going back in my career. I kind of felt like I was just going sideways, right? Like, I just switched a track, if you will.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I think I have a similar feeling to you.
Right. All right. So what would you say in general, like, now that you've started doing this, and I can also share some thoughts, like, just in general, it's hard to give career advice here on kind of a podcast because it's so very individual. But if I'm sure there's a lot of developers out there who are in a similar situation that we have both been in where, you know, they have to decide, you know, do I pursue the kind of management track? Do I try to do something else? Do I just keep being an individual contributor and try to advance that way? What would you say are some things that you try to keep in mind when making these decisions?
I think it has to be something that goes well with you personally. There are different profiles of people. Like, I am one of those people who I want to be involved in everything, like, as much as possible. I'm working at the company because I believe in what the company does and I like the products and I like the projects that we have. and I want to be involved in the decisions, and I want to have the most impact I can in the projects. And that's just something that's intrinsic to me. So I when I got the opportunity, I thought it would go well with me. But that might not be you. Like, if you're the type of person who prefers to really focus in on, like, oh, there's this database we're using and we could optimize this method to go there and not do this. Not that I don't like that sometimes, but it's not, like, the thing I like the most about being a developer. So if you are the type of person who really just cares about the code and other things, then maybe it's not a good fit for you.
Yeah, exactly. Because at the end of the day, like, I think in order to be a really good manager, you have to really focus on the people aspect. And for me, it's interesting because if I think back throughout my career and the managers I've had, the best manager I ever had was not a developer. And the worst manager I've ever had was a developer. And I think that's an important point because sometimes I get the sense that some developers, they don't want to be managed by someone who's not a developer. And I definitely don't have that. I would gladly be managed by someone who's not, because for me, that is not necessary. Like, of course, it helps if they have some technical understanding and they know, or they're at least open-minded to learn kind of the problems that I'm facing and the different choices I have to make and where I'm progressing. But I don't feel like the person needs to be a programmer in order to manage me well.
Yeah, I'd say I'm the same.
Cool. So with that deep dive behind us, let's now move into our final segment for this episode, which is our Ask Stacktrace segment. And Ask Stacktrace is our little segment where you can ask us questions, which is always fun. So if you have anything that you would like our take on, it can be something personal, it can be something technical, it can be whatever you want, really, you can just tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace, and we'll pick it up, hopefully, on a future episode, and try to answer your question. And our question for this week comes from Alexei. And Alexei has an interesting question going, after seeing major features, for example, mouse pointer support in iPadOS 13.4, and now car key in iOS 13.6, do we think that Apple has kind of silently acknowledged the need to shift from a mainly yearly release cycle to instead doing kind of a more continuous rollout of features throughout the year? And I think this is a really interesting question because we've talked about this a fair amount before, how we'd like Apple to move into more like a continuous delivery mindset where they're continuously shipping features throughout the year. So Rambo, do you feel like they have shifted their way of working, or what do you think?
I think if we're talking about them silently moving, I think that's been the case since, I don't know, iOS 11 or something, because it's been the case since a while ago that they will even sometimes announce features at like WWDC, and they will only become available in .1 or .2 releases, and sometimes they add new features in .dot releases. I don't remember the exact features, but I remember that iOS 11.4 added some significant new features and APIs. So I think it has changed, but not now. Like, I think it has changed a while ago. I don't necessarily think that it's possible for them to completely move away from their yearly cycle, because, or at least like move away from sometimes every now and then doing like a big shift, like a WWDC with iOS 14 with lots of new features. Maybe it could be like every other year or not every single year, but sometimes in development, you do need these big like breaks, these big changes that are simply impossible to do slowly. So I think, yeah, basically my answer is yes. they have moved away. They are moving, and they have moved away for a while now. And I think this year, especially with the new iPad stuff, it was a little bit more obvious in a sense, because it was really a big change that pretty much no one was expecting, not for 13.4.
Yeah, and I also feel like two important data points here regarding these examples that Alexei bring up here is, number one, that iOS 13 was kind of infamously having problems in terms of quality, right? Yeah. And there was a lot of features that were cut out of the 13.0, and you mentioned it on the previous episode that, you know, that only shipped on the actual hardware, right? So 13.1 was the release that most people were using. And then new features that were kind of introduced at WWDC in 2019, they were then introduced at point releases, not necessarily because they changed their strategy, but because they just had to adapt because, you know, there was a lot of problems with 13 as a release. And now with Car Key, the reason they're shipping that in 13.6 is because the cars are starting to ship. So you can't have a car without the key, right? So that's, I think, the biggest reason that they're doing it here. So I think that there will be still times when Apple will do this. They will ship these point releases. They will postpone things, perhaps because of quality, because of integrations with other hardware and partners and things like that. But I still think they want to do the yearly thing. That's the feeling I get. Like, they like the big splash, like you also mentioned. Yeah. They like when they can present everything at WWDC and then the beta ship, developers can start integrating it. And then when the phones ship in the fall, it's all good to go. You know, the developer story is there, third-party support is there. Like, that's the best situation. And I think that's what they want to keep doing. But I also feel like the necessities of, you know, the year doesn't just happen at WWDC. It changes over 12 months. I think that will keep causing these things to happen, that they will ship things outside of WWDC and announce them later as well. But a lot of people have mentioned this, and I kind of agree also with, I would sometimes rather them announce like kind of a roadmap at WWDC rather than just ship everything there at once, and to kind of take their time a little bit around polishing and making sure everything has really good quality. And it seems this year they have improved the quality. I from all accounts, I am not running the betas myself, but it seems like most of the betas are pretty solid. And it seems like most of the new APIs are pretty solid, which I have been using, and I've been really enjoying them. So it seems like the quality has been improved, but I think it can perhaps even further be improved by spreading out the releases a little bit more throughout the year, not just having this one big drop in the fall.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that makes perfect sense. And I hope as well that they do more of it and that they keep doing a little splash here and there, but definitely could spread things out a little bit more.
Absolutely. And another thing is regard to kind of developer frameworks that are very young, like take SwiftUI, for example. SwiftUI, you know, had this initial release in 2019, and now it got this big update now in 2020. Since it's such a young framework, it's likely evolving quite rapidly internally at Apple. And I would also like for that to be more kind of continuously delivered, kind of like Swift itself is, where we get, you know, usually a lot of different updates for Swift throughout a given year. And I would also love to see that with individual frameworks, where it's not just here is iOS 14, 15, 16, but here's like Swift UI 2.1, 2.2. I know that Apple doesn't really give numbers to their internal frameworks, but perhaps that would be a good idea so that you could say, I want to depend on this specific version of Swift UI. Now I'm going to bump my version of Swift UI to get this new API, for example.
Yeah, definitely. I would love that. And I'm dreaming, but I would love if they backported some things, like if they released iOS 13.7 with the new stuff in Swift UI, that would be great.
Yeah, one can dream, right? One can dream. All right, but that's it for this episode. So all really that remains is for us to thank you so much for listening, everybody. You're what makes us show up every week to do this episode and record for you. So hope that you enjoyed it. And if you have any feedback that you'd like to give us, they can find us on Twitter. I am at John Sundell, and Mr. Rambo is at _inside. But that's it for this week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.